About enemy alien internment, with a special focus on Crystal City. And with me here today is Yai Ihara and Grace Shimizu, who's busily setting up our table back there, and she'll join us in a minute. My name is Karen Ebel, and I want to thank you very much for joining us today to discuss the issue of internment of the so-called enemy aliens during World War II, with a special focus on the Crystal City Family Camp in Crystal City, Texas. As we discuss the World War II enemy alien internment program and Crystal City, we will also be mindful of how those issues carry forward to today's treatment of immigrants and refugees, how much has changed and how much has remained the same. The human desire for freedom and fair treatment never changes, nor does the need for governments to protect national security. Today we'll see how families get caught in between, and lofty concepts like civil liberties and national security do little to quell the fear of children crying for their parents with floodlights shining through windows and guards taking head counts. As I mentioned, my name is Karen Ebel. I'm the daughter of a German enemy alien internee. My father, Max, never spoke of his internment until 1981, 35 years after he was released from Fort Lincoln in Bismarck, North Dakota. One day, after hearing publicity about the Japanese-American quest for redress, he said to me, "You know, Karen, something like that happened to me." I was very shocked. It wasn't until 1999 that I really comprehended what happened to him and thousands of other Germans here in the U.S. and in Latin America. This is what I learned about my father. He fled Germany in 1937, several months after fighting off Hitler Youth at age 16 because he didn't want to join. He filed his intention to become a U.S. citizen on December 5th, 1941, ironic date, 2 days before Pearl Harbor. He was arrested in Boston in 1942 at age 22 and was shuttled from the Boston Immigration Station, where he helped prevent a fellow Japanese internee's suicide, to Ellis Island, Fort Meade, Maryland, Camp Forest in Tennessee, and finally to North Dakota, where he wrote in his diary upon arrival, "This is hell." In April 1944, after working on the railroad with other so-called trustworthy internees for almost a year out on the plains through the winter, he was drafted to fight in the U.S. Army out of the camp. He flunked his physical and was sent home 2 months later, where he was on probation until 1945. One of the things that drove him nuts is that he wasn't able to go near railroads after he got out, and he had to go the long way around to work. He became a citizen in 1952, and they had such a thick file on him, he commented, "I think you guys know more about me than I do." Since 1999, I've worked to educate the public on the full extent of the U.S. Alien Enemy Control Program, including the creation of the German-American Internee Coalition, and traveling exhibits on the Alien Enemy Control Program, including multicultural projects with Grace Shimizu, who is another panelist here today. I'm also working to pass legislation to study the European American and European Latin American World War II experience, the Wartime Treatment Study Act, which is currently pending in Congress. I'll be talking more about that later, the German experience and Crystal City. Joining me here today, and I'll reintroduce them, is Yai Ihara. She's a former Crystal City internee, and Grace Shimizu, daughter of a Japanese-Peruvian internee and coordinator of the Campaign for Justice and the Japanese-Peruvian Oral History Project, and my friend. As we all know by now, on December 7th, 1941, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Panic ensued, and by the next day, almost 2,000 Japanese and Germans were in custody. In the days and weeks after Pearl Harbor, long-held ethnic and racial prejudices, aggravated by wartime panic, led to the arrest of thousands more German, Italian, and Japanese so-called dangerous enemy aliens. They were arrested under the still viable but little known Alien Enemies Act. It specifies that citizens of enemy nations can be apprehended, restrained, secured, and removed due to a declared war or actual, attempted, or threatened invasion of the United States. Pursuant to the Act, FDR signed three identical presidential proclamations immediately after Pearl Harbor, declaring 600,000 Italian, 300,000 Germans, and 100,000 Japanese U.S. resident aliens over the age of 14 enemy aliens. We've talked some today about what words mean, and that's quite the term. Approximately 1 million immigrants had to register and carry certificates of identification. They could be removed from prohibited zones, and their freedom of movement and property rights were severely restricted. Perhaps most onerous, any enemy alien deemed potentially dangerous to the peace and security of the United States could be interned for the duration of binder of what can happen to any ethnic community when national security fears and wartime terror run amok. The Immigration and Naturalization Service, or INS, was given the responsibility of constructing camps to house the interned aliens, and the Border Patrol assumed responsibility for staffing the camps with guards. Army camps were used until the system was up and running. Eventually, over 50 detention and internment facilities for aliens were established in the United States. And as you know, this system of camps was separate from the WRA camps in which the Japanese Americans were incarcerated. By the fall of 1942, as fathers were taken away, families were separated and struggling. Many families left behind were anxious to be reunited with a mother or father who was interned and would so-called voluntarily join them given the chance. Also, anticipating a flood of Latin American internees, the INS realized it needed a family internment camp. The INS chose the former migrant worker camp in Crystal City, Texas, a dry, dusty area 90 miles southwest of San Antonio. Sporting an incongruous, brightly painted statue of Popeye in the middle of town, Crystal City was the self-declared spinach capital of the world. Originally intended for the Japanese, the first 115 internees arrived in December of 1942. They were German families from Ellis Island. More Japanese and Germans joined them later, as well as a couple hundred Italians. The population wasn't expected to exceed 2,000, but eventually the internee population peaked in December of 1944 to 3,374, and it included almost 700 buildings. 10 miles of roads and walks covered almost 300 acres. All visits were conducted under surveillance, and families were allowed to write only 4 letters and 2 postcards a week. Everything was censored, and 1,000 pieces of mail were reviewed daily. Although technically applicable only to prisoners of war, the INS worked hard to comply with the Geneva Conventions in the hope that similar treatment would be afforded Americans interned abroad. In 1945, the government even made a 45-minute movie of Crystal City Camp, making it look like a resort, showing well-cared-for internees merrily going about their business, with lots of attention to an irrigation pond, or a swimming pool, as they like to call it. Many of the teenagers sported bathing suits and sunglasses. It always reminds me a little bit of Beverly Hills. It is true, most internees feel they were fairly well cared for under the circumstances, but the film did not reflect reality. The camp commander, Joseph O'Rourke, reported that by June 30, 1945, the camp inducted 4,700 internees and included 155 births. The camp didn't close until late 1947, so many more were born, died, and passed through its gates in the next 2 years. He also noted that by April 1943, there were 220 employees and a weekly payroll of $7,200. So it just shows you what amount of money went into maintaining these camps and for what reason, really. O'Rourke attempted to run a model facility, but there was little he could do about the sadness of his occupants. The protections of the Geneva Conventions can't really change the fact that you're interned. Strolling along through this emotion-filled transitional melting pot, one can easily hear Spanish, German, English, Japanese, and Italian, with various dialects coloring the conversation. Children's songs float over the hot breezes from the kindergarten. Japanese farmers hoe in the gardens, German mechanics clank on a tractor, an ice truck trundles by, perhaps driven by Art Shibayama or Eberhard Fuhr. Women hang diapers, a baseball flies through the air, and teens splash in that swimming pool. It seems like a typical small town, but look again. Over there, a child who crawled under the fence to get a grapefruit is surrounded by guards hastily pointing their guns. A red-eyed new mother warily watches a scorpion as she tries to wash her dusty baby under a cold water faucet. And a chain-smoking dad stares aimlessly into space on the side of a dusty road. This small town is really a prison, 100 acres of which are surrounded by a 10-foot chain-link fence capped by barbed wire and punctuated by guard towers, Klieg lights, patrolling armed guards, and dogs. The haunted drawn faces captured by the camp photographers show the turmoil within. Lives torn asunder, homes and livelihoods lost, fear, anger, confusion, resignation, and a great deal of depression. Thousands of miles from home, families wrestle with the unknown. At least 4,000 agreed to go back to Germany and Japan, places where they hadn't been for decades, not knowing the countries had been destroyed by war and that they were basically unwelcome as their relatives struggled to feed themselves. For the exchangees, having some control over their fate seemed better than the barbed wire. Most would regret that choice as bombs fell around them a month later. 60 years later, another desolate patch of land in Texas is the location of a yet another immigrant detention camp. Again, the government faced the problem of what to do with detainee families. The solution was a medium security prison in Taylor, Texas, where children and their families are held pending resolution of their cases, the Don Hutto Residential Center. Unlike World War II, most of these immigrants are not in this country legally, but their predicament is similar, the wrong ethnicity at the wrong time. Margaret Talbot, author of a recent article on the Hutto Center in The New Yorker, spoke with detainee Majid Yurkani. He told her that he and his wife, quote, felt as though they had disappeared into a black hole. We'd ask the officers, what's our future here? What's going to happen to us? What do we need to do? We'd ask, and nobody could tell us. That feeling of having disappeared wasn't entirely irrational. Getting information about Hutto, especially from the people who run it, is very hard. No one knew about Crystal City either, or how to get out. One of the disappeared, Yai Aihara, will now tell us of her family's turmoil. Yai was born in Tacoma, Washington, and raised in Seattle. On December 7, 1941, the FBI arrested her Issei father. In 1942, she was sent with her mother and siblings to an assembly center and then to Minidoka. Eventually, the family was reunited and landed in Crystal City, where they remained for the rest of the war, and she'll share her full story with us. She was married in 1948, raised three sons and a daughter, and she started a cosmetics business and was an esthetician for 25 years. She's now a docent at the Japanese American National Museum and leads weekly exercise classes. No wonder you're in such good shape. We'll have reserved time at the end of the program for questions.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you all for coming today. And I'd like to tell you about what life was like in Crystal City, Texas. Many Issei's and Nisei's had never heard of Crystal City while in the WRA internment camps. I certainly didn't. I think Karen just described how my family got to Crystal City. Since our family had been separated from my father for over a year and a half, Going to Crystal City and living together as a family was a huge relief and just wonderful. Since the heads of family were all considered prisoner of war, the camp had to abide by conditions of the Geneva Convention, so our treatment was very humane. I remember a man from the Swiss consulate visiting the camp to see if everything was operating according to the convention, asking us if we had enough blankets, etc. This camp did not have barracks, but houses. Each house had a flush toilet and was home to about one to three families, and every family had a kitchen sink, a kerosene stove, and an ice box. The only similarity of our houses to the barracks in Minidoka was the thickness of the walls, 3/4 inch, and they were only 6 foot high. Doorways were defined with cloth curtains. We were given X amount of camp use tokens regularly, which the mothers exchanged for food at the market. The amount of food received depended on the number of people in the family. Excuse me. My mother was a good cook, so we ate very well. Many people grew vegetables and flowers. Fresh milk and ice were delivered daily by the Nisei boys. We were subject to daily roll call, and mail incoming and outgoing was censored. Outgoing mail was limited to 2 letters a week. My 2 younger brothers were still of high school age, so they attended Federal High School, which had about 150 students. The high school was a regular school-like building, unlike the barrack schools in the WRA camp. Most subjects except chemistry and physics were taught. I had gotten my high school diploma in Assembly Center, so I went to Japanese school every day. Every subject was taught in Japanese, including language, history, geography, government, calligraphy, math, Chinese writings, art, the works, all were taught by Buddhist priests. Most of the Peruvian students went to Japanese school as they spoke no English. There was also a grammar school. Sports was very popular camp-wide, especially basketball and softball. There was a German section in the camp which I never went to. Not that it was forbidden, but generally, the Germans and the Japanese stayed in their own sections, and there was never any problems between the two groups. A few Niseis went regularly to the German section, primarily to participate in the musical events, oompa bands and orchestra, also ping pong tournaments. One friend, Keiko, an accomplished pianist, was a participant as well as an accompanist for German singers. One thing, she said Mendelssohn was never played because he was Jewish. The Iseis were never exposed to Western music while they were growing up in Meiji Japan, so consequently, most Niseis were never exposed to it either, unless they had music class in school or unless they studied a musical instrument. The music in the Japanese section would be shigin, Chinese poetry recitation, or nagauta. Old movies were shown regularly. One year, we Nisei decided to have a carnival. Every club got 2 choices of what booth they would have. We drew straws to determine who got the most desirable booths. With the proceeds of this carnival, we rented the latest movies. We saw National Velvet, Last of the Mohicans, and The Story of Irene and Vernon Castle. This movie was really censored. We invited the Germans to attend as they had contributed their funds to the successful carnival. Different holidays were celebrated by both groups. At the German functions, it always ended with a Nazi salute and a resounding Sieg Heil. On Hitler's birthday, large placards with his picture, as well as other prominent men of the regime, were carried as they marched. On two occasions, I saw a group of young German boys goose-stepping around the camp. For the Japanese celebrations, celebrations ended with Tennoheika Banzai, which was shouted three times with both arms going up, each with each banzai. Once, we were allowed to leave the camp for a hike accompanied by several guards. I can't remember how many of us participated, but it was nice to leave the confines of the barbed wire. We picked up pecans which had fallen off the trees. For someone like me, who was raised in hilly Seattle, it was so amusing that the guards referred to mounds as hills, as Texas is so flat that any soil that is over 3 feet high is referred to as a hill. There were several very old-fashioned Japanese teachers who had very narrow-minded views about social customs. One year, when the high school had their first graduation celebration, they invited all students to the junior-senior prom. The Japanese school immediately sent out a circular to all the residents forbidding any student to attend, claiming that in Japan, only prostitutes engaged in dancing. My father, who had met the famous Japanese dancer Michiro Ito in one of his camps, had learned social dancing from him. He was so incensed with this that in defiance, he ordered my brothers and me to go. We did. I had fun, but my poor Japanese school homeroom teacher was so brutally ostracized by his colleagues, I was just stunned. I never lived it down. Many of the Isseis were Japanese nationalists, imbued with the so-called Yamato Damashi, a fiercely fighting spirit. It is this fighting, don't give up spirit, that they taught to the Niseis, and with which they fought so bravely in Europe during the war. The 442 adopted it as their motto, go for broke. When the war ended, I was surprised that so many of the Isseis believed that Japan had won the war. In December, a repatriation ship was to go to Japan. Many families signed up. My brothers and I got together, stood up to my father, and told him we would not go to Japan, and he just nodded okay. We were so surprised that he, who was one of the first Issei men to sign up for repatriation, agreed with us. Only at the Crystal City reunion in 1988 did I find out why we didn't go. Our friend Marion from Seattle came to the reunion and told us that when her brother, Hank, a MIS soldier stationed in the South Pacific, had visited their family in Crystal City during the war, he told my father in utmost secrecy not to go to Japan because Japan was losing the war. My father took that secret to his grave. Those diehard Isseis realized that Japan had lost when the repatriation ship docked in Uraga, Japan, and American MPs were everywhere. One painful time for us, when my sister's husband, who had volunteered for the 442nd out of Minidoka, sent overseas after training in Mississippi, was reported missing in action. After 1 year, he was declared killed in action, and we had a very pitiable memorial service with no altar or flowers, only incense. I could not even console my sister with a phone call. There was no such thing as long distance in those days. I had turned 20 when the war ended. Time came to leave camp, but my mother was recovering from major surgery, and the doctor advised us to go to a warmer place other than cold Seattle. In one of my father's camps, he had the good fortune to meet a man who had come from the very same village in Wakayama, and to an Issei in America that's like family. He had recognized my father's name as his oldest brother. My father's oldest brother had been the soncho, or village chief. He offered us to stay at his home in Boyle Heights in Los Angeles, which we did. We left Crystal City with $25 each and a one-way train ticket to Los Angeles, and we started our lives over from scratch. Today at the campsite, there is a historical marker which was erected in 1985 through the efforts of several townspeople, Izumi Taniguchi and other individuals. We former inmates raised over $5,000 to erect it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, because I'm the moderator and a speaker, you get to hear me twice. So just as you can tell from Yai's story, internment was not simply a story of numbers, facts, and figures. Only through the personal experiences of those who lived it can one understand the ramifications. And then one must judge whether national security gained by internment policies can justify the anguish suffered. I would argue that the government could have refined its methods. Those interned were found guilty of no crimes. If there had been hard evidence, they would have been imprisoned or shot for treason. Instead, innuendo sufficed. Surely some internees held suspicious beliefs at the time, but none of the beliefs were illegal in a land where freedom of speech was revered. While racism resulted in many more Japanese Americans being incarcerated, white skin was not necessarily a shield against discrimination if one was the wrong ethnicity. Depending on the circumstances, anyone can be the enemy, as we learn time and again. Discrimination on the basis of race, ethnicity, nationality, and religion is equally abhorrent. Unfortunately, few know of the Alien Enemy Control Program and its broad reach. They really should. I'd like to share with you some of the German voices I know to give you a taste of how these laws have the power to ruin lives. They were all at Crystal City. The first one is Star Pate Gurka. She was one of 4,000 German Latin American residents who were deported to the U.S. She happened to be a U.S. citizen whose German alien husband was taken by the Costa Rican government and imprisoned, and she wrote to her brother, "Dear Charles, since the day before yesterday, Werner has been in the local penitentiary. For a week before, he was under house arrest, and even then we were happy. We haven't the remotest idea why they arrested him or what's going to happen to him and the many others there. And they won't let me see anyone to find out the charges against him or to do any explaining. Heidi wakes up at night screaming, 'Poppy, Poppy,' and today is Ingrid's first birthday. As you see, my heart is breaking. With all my love, Star." Soon the Gurka family was on its way with hundreds of others to Crystal City. As reported by Louis Fisset in his 2003 article on the Public Health Service's care of internees at Crystal City, quote, "The first medical crisis occurred in February following the arrival of 131 German nationals from Costa Rica who had been held briefly in San Pedro near Los Angeles. 55 cases of children's whooping cough were discovered, as well as 8 cases of impetigo. 2 children arrived with acute medical needs requiring immediate outside hospitalization. Most of the adults suffered from severe respiratory ailments. In all, 66 needed immediate medical attention, and it was feared that others who manifested symptoms of simple colds might turn into medical cases. What isn't said here is that the diseases were the direct result of the horrendous conditions where internees were held in Costa Rica before being shipped out and on board the boats while they were being transported." This is a short story about Rosemarie Neupert, age 9. She was held in Ellis Island with her intern mother. Her naturalized German father couldn't care for her, but eventually the whole family would head to Crystal City. Rosemarie writes that on Ellis Island, we spent our days in the Great Hall, an enormous room that was dingy, dirty, and gray with age. The building was alive with roaches. Every time anything would be moved, the roaches would scurry about. There was nothing to do other than stay in this huge room where rats were not unusual. We were allowed to go outside for a short time each day. We could see the Statue of Liberty's back and the skyline of downtown Manhattan. At night, we slept in the rooms that led off the balcony that ran around the Great Hall. The rooms were tiled, and there was a lavatory in each room. There were about 8 women in our room and 2 children. We were locked in each night, and there were 2 small barred windows set up high in the wall. On Saturdays, when my dad came to visit us, I would stand on a dresser and pull myself up to the windows to see the ferry had arrived. And then we would go to the Great Hall and wait for Dad to come and see us. We were supposed to stay on one side of the divider and not kiss Dad, but we did anyway. He would bring us food when he could because what we were given on Ellis Island was almost inedible. I would take my plate to my mother, who would try to make the food more palatable by doing things like removing the skin from the chicken because it had only been partially plucked. Ugh. Also headed to Crystal City to join his parents was high school senior Eberhard Fuhrer. In May 1983, while in class at Woodward High School, 1943, while in class at Woodward High School in Cincinnati, 2 FBI agents arrested me. I was 17. When passing through the doorways, one would proceed with a drawn pistol, while the other would hold my left arm. When we got outdoors, I was handcuffed. I never returned to school and did not graduate 2 short months later. I lost my letter jacket. 2 FBI agents then took me to my 19-year-old brother's place of employment where he was arrested. We'd been trying to make it on our own after our parents and 12-year-old brother were taken away right after Pearl Harbor. We were taken to a city police station where we were booked on suspicion, fingerprinted, and taken to Hamilton County Prison. This was built in the mid-1800s and had a medieval look of turrets with very high walls. A 5-tiered cell block dominated the interior. Each cell was about 5 by 10 with a metal bucket as a toilet. A bed hung from the wall by 2 chains and the walls were about 2 feet thick. We were given prison clothes and locked in separate cells some distance apart. Soon after the barred doors clanged shut, the prisoners, convicted criminals, began yelling vicious threats about Nazis, Krauts, Huns, and what we could expect just as soon as the cells would open in the morning. We hardly slept. We were brought to the federal building for our hearings. No witnesses or counsel were permitted. While my brother had his hearing, I was given a copy of the Cincinnati Inquirer. In shock, I read, 2 brothers interned. They will have a hearing, and they will be interned. We hadn't had our hearings yet, but the newspaper announced our arrest and internment. Fuhrer graduated from high school at Crystal City, where he remained until 1947, when he was transferred with his family to Ellis Island, slated for deportation. Finally, he was released later that year. And last, I'd like to share with you the story of Lothar Iserloh. He was 5 when his mother and 2 sisters, aged 3 and 8, joined his father in Crystal City from Strongsville, Ohio. Matthias was arrested on December 7, 1941, after having lived here for 20 years. The family had struggled on its own, but finally they applied to go to Crystal City, and later they were exchanged to Germany. As you will see, nothing could really stop this process. Unless, I guess, if the ship was too crowded, right? Yeah. This quote is from a report by Special Agent William Mangles to his superior on January 9, 1945, regarding the transfer of German aliens from Crystal City to the MS Gripsholm in Jersey City, New Jersey. This is the report. All repatriates were kept incommunicado after final customs examinations and body frisk. At no time were they able to pass or receive any verbal or written communications. The first section left on the train from Crystal City at 11 p.m., and the second section left at about 11:15 p.m. on the 2nd. On January 4th, there was born en route on the train to the repatriate Johanna Iserloh, wife of Matthias Iserloh, also a repatriate, a son, Gunther, certification signed by your agent attached hereto. According to instructions, 5 additional repatriates were taken on board the first section with their baggage in New Orleans on January 4th. We arrived in Jersey City at 9 a.m. on the 6th, and all repatriates were put on board the MS Gripsholm. Entire trip was made without untoward incident. I don't know how the woman who had the baby would feel about that comment. In February 1945, after being exchanged, the Iserlohs climbed onto an open truck and were taken to Aschaffenburg, a town completely destroyed by bombs. Left on their own and struggling with the sickly infant, the family slowly made their way north across war-ravaged Germany. Amidst bombings and air raids, in the middle of a record-breaking winter, they traveled by train when possible, but often they had to walk because the railways were destroyed. During the last leg of their journey, U.S. planes strafed their train. Frightened, they huddled under the seats until the train stopped. They ran with the other passengers to the woods nearby, and the planes continued gunning the train. An anti-aircraft gun on the last train car was put into action, and the family watched sadly as smoke filled the sky where 2 of the American planes were shot down. They arrived in Idstein during the first days of March, hungry and exhausted. Their family was really shocked and not at all happy that they'd come. Their relatives, like the rest of the country, had no food for themselves, never mind a family of 6 with a newborn. Johanna's aging parents could only offer them a small corner in their cellar for living quarters. What little food that could be had was primarily bartered for on the black market. The family was now suffering from symptoms of malnutrition. They were often ill-treated, having just arrived from America. Local Nazis and townspeople were suspicious. They couldn't comprehend why anyone who wasn't a spy would return from America during the war. 2 weeks after they arrived in Idstein, 6 overzealous SS members severely beat Matthias in their basement home in full view of his terrified wife and children. The Gestapo arrested Matthias and took him away to another unknown prison, suspecting him of being an undercover spy for the advancing U.S. military. The family didn't know if he was alive or dead until the end of the war, some months later, when he was found, thoroughly questioned, and then released by the occupying U.S. Army. Ironically, the government that imprisoned him in America was responsible for his family's of his release and probably saved his life. How did these people find themselves in this predicament? The Alien Enemies Act, which remains in force. Were these people Americans or were they German? Should the fact that they were aliens have resulted in this? Crystal City is the focus of some of the worst anguish because of the family turmoil. And because so little is known of the Alien Enemies Act, and I guess because I'm a lawyer, I'd like to tell you a little bit about about how people ended up in these Department of Justice internment camps. And while I talk about the law, I'd like to encourage you to remain mindful of the Patriot Act and its effect on aliens today. Could the courts provide relief for these people? We'll see. On July 3rd, 1947, an issue of the New York Times reported the following: 700 enemy aliens, including 305 Germans on Ellis Island, face imminent deportation as a result of a decision yesterday by the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The decision, sustained by a ruling by District Judge Simon Rifkin, who last August dismissed a writ of habeas corpus in a test case brought by a 31-year-old bartender, Herman Schleuder. Judge Rifkin was complimented by the circuit court upon the excellence of his opinion that held that Schleuder, who had protested he was not permitted an attorney or privilege of examining witnesses, was entitled to no hearing, and therefore he could not complain of the quality of hearing that he got. That was the catch-22 in which enemy aliens found themselves during World War II. They couldn't complain because they had no rights except those granted them by the government which interned them. In other words, be happy with what you get because you're entitled to nothing. As you now know, the Department of Justice had total authority over the enemy aliens. DOJ decided who to investigate, who to arrest, and who to intern, applying a standard of suspicious of being dangerous to the peace and security of the United States. DOJ ran the camps, decided who to release and when. There was no right to a rehearing. According to the terms of the original three Alien Enemies Act proclamations, this authority was for the duration of the war, and most internees thought they'd be free at the cessation of hostilities. This turned out not to be the case. Detainees weren't entitled to a hearing, but the Attorney General decided the internment decision required some sort of hearing as a matter of fairness. Obviously, being sent to camps with no hearing, like tens of thousands of Japanese Americans, is worse, but interposing a sham hearing isn't that great either. The Attorney General issued a presidential warrant authorizing the FBI to enter any home occupied by an enemy alien to perform a search for incriminating articles. Different FBI agents perform these duties with varying degrees of zealousness, but many recall their homes being ransacked at odd hours of the day, often at gunpoint. The arrests were frequently traumatic because the family didn't know why their loved ones were arrested and where they were being taken. They just disappeared. 9-year-old Doris Berg Nye's parents were dragged away from their home in Honolulu. She thought they'd been killed. She and her younger sister were left alone for 5 days till her older sister, Elle, came back from an adjoining island. Then she, too, was taken. Doris was hysterical, clinging to the car when the FBI agent came to take her away, screaming, "Don't kill Elle, too!" Both Elle and Mr. Berg were U.S. citizens. Those arrested were initially held in makeshift detention facilities scattered across the U.S., hospitals, jails, for women convents, and homes for wayward girls, INS facilities for seamen, and barracks, any place they could find. After a period of weeks or months, the detainees were called for hearing. Hearing boards were composed of three community members selected by the DOJ and were in various regions of the U.S. They were charged to make a recommendation of internment, parole, or release following the hearing. That determination was made by the Alien Enemy Control Unit in Washington. The U.S. Attorney for the District presented the evidence, which was also reviewed by the hearing board in secret before the hearing. No hearing transcripts were required, and only summary documents were sent to Washington. Everything was in secret. Washington reviewed the documents and could require additional investigation. In the meantime, the detainees sat in their detention centers knowing nothing, nor did their family. The arrests were not secret and could frequently be big news in communities, and sadly that left many behind, shunned, with no friends, especially people who were nervous that if they talked to them, they'd be next. After the AG issued his order, which could take weeks, the detainee was advised of the decision, and if internment was ordered, he was hastily transferred to a permanent facility. Rehearings were permitted only at the AG's discretion. At least today, a rehearing is granted for most immigrants stuck in the system, even if the schedule is protracted. The standard required new evidence to be provided, which was hard to come up with when one was behind barbed wire. Regardless of the conditions, families who ended up in Crystal City together were happy to be together, especially because assets were frozen and families couldn't make it on the outside. Voluntary internment is really a myth. How voluntary is it if your family is separated indefinitely? On the subject of voluntary internment, I just want to share with you this quote from Commander O'Rourke's Crystal City report about voluntary internment. "It's the general opinion of our staff that voluntary internment should not be permitted. Our observation formed the opinion that a woman, because of her usual emotional state, will generally develop an anti-American complex through internment, even if no prior attitude existed." Looking back at Judge Rifkin's quote, "If you have no rights during war but those granted by the police power which can investigate and imprison you, what rights do you really have? And how fairly will your rights be administered?" The Alien Enemies Act remains on the books today and was deemed constitutional by the Supreme Court now long ago. Are we doing a better job today? Who will be the enemy next, and how will we balance the rights of those we suspect against our national security concerns? Will it be Albanians, North Koreans, or maybe even the French? Will they land in prison in Texas indefinitely or be deported? What is the correct approach to these questions, and who really is Americans? These are some of the issues that the commission created by the Wartime Treatment Study Act, which I'm working on, can consider as it analyzes the wartime policies of the U.S. government regarding European Americans and Latin Americans. It was originally introduced in 2001, and the bill has been pending for 8 years. As much as is known about the Japanese Americans, virtually nothing is known of the Germans and the Italians. Their experience should not be ignored or minimized. Recognizing all the ethnic groups affected by World War II policies adds power to the argument that our civil liberties must be protected during crises. It doesn't detract. All the children who played together at Crystal City deserve recognition by the U.S. government. The study is long overdue. Most who have suffered have already passed away, including my own father last year, and those remaining are aging rapidly. I hope you will help us get this bill passed. There's information about the bill at the back of the room. So that concludes my talk, and now I would like to turn the discussion over to Grace Shimizu, who's the daughter of a Japanese-Peruvian internee held in Crystal City. Grace will share with us the history of the U.S. Latin American program, pursuant to which over 6,000 Japanese, German, and Italian men, women, and children were taken from 19 Latin American countries, interned in the U.S., and many later exchanged for Americans held in Germany and Japan. She is the coordinator of the Japanese-Peruvian Oral History Project and Campaign for Justice, Redress Now for Japanese Latin Americans, and the project director of the traveling exhibit, The Enemy Alien Files, Hidden Stories of World War II. She has community and campus experience spanning over 37 years, including issues of affirmative action, peace and international solidarity, and human rights. She is a leading organizer for the documentation of the World War II rendition experience of former Japanese Latin American internees and their redress struggle to secure U.S. government accountability for their experiences, including the creation of a commission through the passage of the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Latin Americans of Japanese Descent. Thank you, Grace.
On behalf of the former Japanese, Latin American, and internees and our families, I want to thank the conference organizers and for all of you who have joined us today. It's so heartening to be able to share our wartime and redress experiences. For us, it's very significant because our experiences have never been part of the mainstream historical narrative of this country, nor have our experiences been included as part of our own community's historical narrative, both Japanese American and Latino communities. Our story is a hidden or marginalized part of our Nikkei community's history, and it is a suppressed part of U.S. history. My father was a Japanese national residing in Peru who was interned in Crystal City concentration camp in Texas during World War II. He passed away about 4 years ago at age 97, and he was one of the oldest survivors of the World War II Latin American rendition program organized by the United States government. My father was born in 1906 in Hiroshima, Japan, and he emigrated to Peru when he was 18 years old. He joined his brother, who had arrived earlier as a contract laborer, and began to develop a family business there. During the war, our family business was targeted and put on the blacklist. In 1944, when my dad was 38 years old, he was apprehended and forcibly deported to the U.S. military camp in the Panama Canal Zone for detention at hard labor, and then brought to the United States for indefinite internment for the purpose of hostage exchange. Other family members who were taken from Peru were interned in the U.S. and either used in the prisoner exchange during the war or deported to Japan after the war. My dad's first wife died in the Crystal City camp. Seven other members of our family who remained in Peru were killed during the war, but my father was not allowed to return to Peru to investigate, so circumstances surrounding their murders is not clear. At the end of the war, my dad was released on parole from the camp under the sponsorship of Japanese-American relatives we had who live in Northern California. He eventually remarried and started a family. In the 1950s, with changes in the immigration laws, he was allowed to change his status from illegal alien to permanent resident. I didn't understand the significance of my dad's wartime experience until I began to work with the Japanese Peruvian Oral History Project, which was established in 1991 by six Japanese Peruvian families in the San Francisco Bay Area. Through our work, we learned how the internment and redress history of Japanese Americans and Japanese Latin Americans is intricately linked. We learned how the U.S. government initiated and orchestrated a rendition program from Latin America, and how this Latin American program was a component of a larger World War II enemy alien program. And this is how the U.S. government decided to deal with people it considered the enemy, or more accurately, potentially dangerous enemy aliens. So what many of us have known as the World War II Japanese-American incarceration is now put into a broader international context of mass relocation, internment, and forced deportation of persons of Japanese, German, and Italian ancestry. They show a shocking picture of how the U.S. government initiated and orchestrated a conscious, systematic, planned program of massive civil rights violations, war crimes, and crimes against humanity spanning two continents before, during, and after World War II. And later review of these records of the so-called dangerous enemy aliens show there was often no specific evidence of subversive activities. Rather, they lost years of their lives on the basis of potential danger. And the impact of these violations has been long-lasting in our families and in our communities, and has current day significance for our democratic institutions and freedoms. So let's look more at what we're calling the Latin American Rendition Program. From December 7, 1941, when Pearl Harbor was attacked, through December 1945, over 6,000 men, women, and children of German, Italian, and Japanese ancestry from 19 Latin American countries, both immigrants, residents of those countries, as well as citizens of those countries, were taken from their homes and businesses, forcibly deported, and interned in U.S. concentration camps. Those of German ancestry numbered over 4,000 and included 81 Jewish refugees who had fled the European war zones seeking safe haven in Latin America. There were also about 288 persons of Italian ancestry and 2,264 of Japanese ancestry. My dad was one of nearly 1,800 persons of Japanese ancestry taken from Peru. These enemy aliens included a wide range of individuals. Several hundred of the Germans, at least 71 Japanese, and an unknown number of Italians were diplomats and their families. But the vast majority were businessmen like my dad, ministers, priests, newspaper editors, teachers, leaders of community and cultural groups, as well as their spouses and children. Of these civilians, there were an unknown number who were so-called volunteers who were eager to rejoin their homelands to help in the war effort. However, the vast majority were involuntary deportees who were under duress or coerced by threats of arrest or other consequences and expelled from their countries of residence by the local authorities acting at the behest of the U.S. government. They were kidnapped, detained, and interned for reasons of national security, but without charges, incarcerated for indefinite duration, held without trial, and many forcibly deported to war zones in the Far East and Europe in the prisoner exchange. It was massive racial and ethnic profiling. It was rendition. It was ethnic cleansing. This was carried out in the name of national security, but largely motivated by fear, economic profiteering, political opportunism, historic racism, and anti-foreign prejudice. So why did the U.S. target the civilians in Latin America? Well, the U.S. has long had an interest in Latin America. Since the early 1820s, with the Monroe Doctrine, the U.S. has considered the Americas to be within its sphere of influence, its own backyard. The U.S. has particularly been concerned that about European countries, that they don't colonize any of the Americas as a matter of national security. So as the war spread in Europe by the mid-30s, the U.S. became particularly concerned with German influence in Latin America. And by the end of the 30s, the U.S. officials were concerned that the communities of Axis nationals in Latin America would engage in subversive activities like espionage or sabotage or promoting pro-Axis propaganda. In 1940, and this is before Pearl Harbor, the U.S. diplomats and intelligence agents began preparing lists of dangerous enemy aliens residing in Latin America. And in October 1941, there was a secret agreement between the U.S. and the Panama, whereby if the United States were to get into the war, the Panamanian government agreed to round up the Japanese and German and Italians in Panama and put them in detention, with the U.S. assuming all the expenses and responsibility. As it happened, in December, 2 months later, there was the Japanese military attack on Pearl Harbor, and the U.S. entered into World War II. And as a result, there began the seizure of Axis nationals in Panama and other countries. People started disappearing off the streets. And in the following month, in January 1942, the Latin American countries adopted the U.S. plan to coordinate hemispheric security measures, which included detention, deportation, internment in the U.S., and prisoner exchange. This was able to happen so quickly because it was actually already began to be thought of and planned before the attack on Pearl Harbor. Let's see. In 1942, the U.S. policy began shifting from the concern about national security to destruction of the long-term commercial presence of Axis nationals in Latin America. So the economy was the main interest. Economic measures included blacklisting of businesses, freezing of bank accounts, closure and seizures of businesses and property. In several cases, individual deportees were clearly targeted because of their important economic role in their countries of residence, even when there was no evidence they assisted the Axis governments. These civilians from Latin America were not a threat to U.S. national security. The lack of evidence or even accusation against the majority of the deportees led the Department of Justice officials to conclude that many of them had been wrongly seized and interned. Throughout the region, U.S. intelligence agents often spoke neither Spanish nor German and never Japanese, and they relied on anonymous denunciations or statements of paid informants, which they usually accepted at face value. And this resulted in many cases of mistaken identity or slander, but they were only uncovered at the end of the war when the Department of Justice had a review of the internees. Let's see. So while asserting a desire to protect U.S. national security, the economic motive became overriding for the Latin American governments and the U.S. interests to control German property and businesses. For the Japanese Latin Americans, the principal motivation was their seizure for hostage exchange. The U.S. government became interested in prisoner exchange even before entering World War II. By 1939, the U.S. government began to have secret negotiations with the Axis powers to talk about repatriating U.S. citizens held in the war zones of Europe and the Far East if the U.S. should be drawn into the war. So during the war, over 4,800 men, women, and children were forcibly deported into the war zones of the Far East in Europe in this prisoner exchange. And these included U.S. citizens who were the minor children of permanent resident aliens. For persons of German ancestry in the United States and from Latin America, there were 6 exchanges of at least 2,000 people. Of them, it's unclear how many were German Latin Americans. For persons of Japanese ancestry, there were two exchanges, with over 2,800 civilians exchanged, including over 1,200 from Latin America. In September 1945, with Allied victory and Japan's formal surrender, the hardship facing internees from Latin America did not end. The U.S. government informed those that remained in the United States that they were illegal aliens and that they had to leave the U.S., not only the U.S., but the entire Western Hemisphere. This hit the Japanese Peruvians particularly hard. Most of the 1,400 of them wanted to return to their homes in Peru. But initially, the Peruvian government refused them re-entry, even if they were Peruvian citizens or married to Peruvian citizens. So as a result, between November 1945 and June 1946, over 900 Japanese Latin Americans were deported to war-devastated Japan. More than 300 of the Peruvians who decided to remain in the United States, they tried to fight deportation. And many were sponsored out of the camps by their Japanese American relatives, or else they were paroled under the sponsorship of the Seabrook Farms in New Jersey and used as cheap labor. Eventually, about 100 of the Japanese Peruvians were able to return to Peru. In 1954, the immigration law was amended, so all the internees from the Latin American countries who were still in the United States, they could begin the process of changing their illegal alien status and become permanent residents, and many later became U.S. citizens. For the internees from Latin America who had been exchanged during the war or deported after the war to Europe or Asia, they faced dire circumstances resettling amidst the war devastation. Most were never able to return to their homes in Latin America. For those in the U.S. government, they would like you to think that the wartime experience of person of Japanese ancestry, both the U.S. citizens and immigrants, and our struggle for redress is over, that it's a closed chapter. And many people have accepted this because of the passage of the historic Civil Liberties Act of 1988 and the completion of a 10-year redress program whereby the majority of former Japanese-American internees received an apology letter and their symbolic compensation payment. But for the enemy aliens of World War II, our struggle for acknowledgement, truth, justice, redress, it's not over. Now, the Italians were able to get a study bill passed and a report published, and there some level of acknowledgement was granted about the injustices they faced during the war. But still, the Italian internees, they have not gotten an apology nor any education funds. And Karen mentioned earlier about the Wartime Treatment Study Act pending before Congress. So there are many German from the United States as well as Latin Americans who have not gotten any acknowledgement of what happened, let alone any redress. And still, there are actually hundreds of Japanese Americans who were denied redress under the Civil Liberties Act. And the Japanese Latin Americans, for the most part, they were considered ineligible for redress, even though we were in the same camps of Japanese Americans, because we were somehow classified to be illegal aliens, when actually it was the United States that brought us here to begin with. So how could we be illegal aliens? And then also, we should note that the educational mandate of the Civil Liberties Act has not been fulfilled. If people remember, when the redress legislation was being shopped around, our community, our nation, was promised $50 million of education and research monies so that people could learn more about what happened to our community and that it wouldn't be repeated. But only $5 million was actually spent in the last year of the 10-year redress program. So many consider that the educational mandate has not been fulfilled, our community, the whole nation, is due $45 million worth of education and research activities and programs. And after 9/11, we've come to better understand the importance, the significance and relevance of our community's experience and why we need to remember our past so we don't repeat the mistakes in the future. And unfortunately, we're seeing that the things that happened to our Issei, to our first generation, whether they're Japanese or German or Italian, they are actually being repeated today. History is being repeated today by communities that are now seen as the new enemy, whether they're Arab or Muslim or South Asian community members. So the Japanese Latin Americans, I'd like to focus a little bit about that since that's my area of work. The government, you know, excluded us from redress. They said we were ineligible because we just didn't fit within the Civil Liberties Act. They somehow interpreted that law not to include us. And so they basically said, we're sorry, but you're just not included. You're going to have to sue us. So that's what we did. We filed the Mochizuki lawsuit, and we were able to craft a controversial settlement agreement that maybe some of you are aware of, where the government said, we want to stop this litigation. We want to kick out this lawsuit, and we'll give you an apology letter, and we'll give you $5,000. Take it or leave it. There's enough money for everybody, so take it or leave it. As it turned out, after the majority of the Japanese Peruvian internees decided that was important to do because this would be the first time the government would ever acknowledge that this happened, and it was important to have that apology letter in the hands, especially of the older Issei before they passed away. So the majority of us agreed to do that. But then after our agreement, the government informed us, well, there's not really enough money for everybody. And then when we got the apology letter, it didn't say Latin America, and it didn't say what happened, really. We just apologized for injustices during the war. And so I think many people feel that while it was important, you know, to go through the Mochizuki settlement and have that, we still feel that we need to get the U.S. government to acknowledge, to do full disclosure what happened. And that's not just important for us, for our families, but it's actually important for the whole country so that we begin to understand what happened and so that the mistakes, again, not be repeated. And so there were those. So what has happened is we've continued, you know, litigation in different forms, and we now have a petition pending before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights because basically we couldn't find justice in the U.S. courts. And we're waiting a decision on basically the failure of the U.S. government to provide redress for war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's the level of the violations that occurred to our families. And in addition to this kind of international litigation, we have legislation pending. We want to have a Japanese Latin American Commission study bill passed. And we hope to go to Washington, D.C. at the end of this month for a hearing before the House Judiciary Subcommittee around that bill. So we hope that you will be hearing more about it and that you will support us. We would like you to support not only our bill, but also the bill that Karen's working on. In the back, there's a table with support letters. If you could please sign them and leave them there, we will deliver them to Congress when we go to D.C. There's also a lot of materials back there that we've developed. So please learn more, and we hope that you will help share the information, because this stuff really isn't in the history books and is really being spread by word of mouth. So if you could help us, we have a number of really good books like On the Enemy Alien Program like this one, and then also DVD, which are excerpts from testimonies from German and Italian and Japanese and Latin American internees. And this one also has excerpts from testimony from Arab, Muslim, and South Asian members of our community talking about what's happened to them post 9/11. And we, in 2006, we delivered this to members of Congress. So hopefully they're looking at it and learning from it. Let's see. And then just to kind of wrap up, I just want to say that the Nikkei community really knows very well what's been done in the name of national security, not just the mass internment of citizens and immigrants, but also the human impact of that traumatic experience on our families and our communities. And in the immediate aftermath, you know, of the attack on Pearl Harbor, but also through the years of internment and afterwards, and its even continuing effects on our succeeding generations. And during World War II, the U.S. courts didn't protect our constitutional and our human rights. And our the internment that our families and relatives went through, it's still on the books. It's still legal to do that. And so it still has the Supreme Court's seal of approval. So while we're not seeing mass incarceration in the United States repeating itself yet, we do see history repeating itself with even more sinister twists and turns. We see racial profiling, discriminatory immigration policies, detentions without charge or due process, expedited deportation, kidnapping, sexual assault, torture, murder. These policies have sown the seeds of distrust and divisiveness throughout our country. And we've seen the rise in verbal abuse, physical violence, hate crimes, discrimination and exploitation in the workplace, and political disempowerment. Now in the halls of Congress, in the courts, and in all sectors of our society, we're confronting the war on terrorism abroad and here at home. We're seeing our civil liberties being curtailed in the name of national security. While many of us in the U.S. and around the world, we don't feel that the world is becoming a safer place. There's no end in sight for the occupation of Iraq. And even those in the military are questioning the legality and morality of the war. And the conflict in that region continues to intensify in Gaza and has expanded to invasion and destruction of Lebanon. Threats to invade Iran raise the possibility of nuclear war. Billions of dollars are being spent each month on foreign war. Budgets are being cut for domestic education, healthcare, and social services. And the profits of the war profiteers are soaring. Government corruption, cronyism, incompetence, negligence. Need I mention the man-made Katrina disaster? Conflicts of interest in our courts, Congress, and the media. Subversion of our electoral system, even as we enter into the race for presidency. We're in the midst of a crisis in our country, a constitutional crisis, a crisis for our democracy, an all-sided political, economic, social, cultural, and moral crisis. What's at stake for us here is a history based on truth and accuracy. What we want is documentation, preservation, and interpretation of history, especially the history of those in our society and our own communities who have been consistently marginalized and disempowered. What we don't want is distortion and manipulation that co-opts our history, which supports a model minority interpretation of our history, or which uses our experience to justify the mistreatment of those vulnerable in our society, especially during times of war. And what we want is to draw lessons from our own history and to gain insight into the concerns we face today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Grace. We're about 5 minutes over, but in our defense, we started 10 minutes late. So I don't know if we do have the plenary session that's starting, but if anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to hear them. Ma'am?
She started
Yeah, from Minidoka. We went to from Minidoka to Ellis Island, and my. Oh, well, my sister refused to go because she already had a boyfriend. But my mother, my two brothers, and I, we were separated from my father. So we went from Minidoka to Ellis Island. My father went from Lordsburg to Ellis Island, where we were reunited. And my father was considered a prisoner of war, so he couldn't go back to Minidoka with us. So the authorities told us if we want to stay together, we go to this family camp, which was set up for that type of, our type of family that was separated. So we went to. Yeah. Can't hear you. I think some of the later residents did not have them, but yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't.
I think some did and some didn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Depends on when you came into the camp.
Some of the German families even had showers in their houses. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, the first people that came to the camp got the best stuff, and then progressively, you know, more and more people came, and the facilities got worse and worse as the camp was expanding. Mm-hmm. So. Anybody else? Nope. Okay. Thank you very much.